Welcome back to Slightly Foxed. Warmer days now, and today we're discussing a book where a sinister event takes place, quite unexpectedly, on an overpoweringly hot day. It's one of the great Australian novels, but before we get to that, let's hear what's going on at Slightly Foxed. Gail Perkis is on the line. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I'm knee-deep in proofs at the moment. We've got a lot of books coming out this autumn, and I'm trying to get ahead of myself and get them off to the printer in good time.
Anything you can tell us about?
Well, we've got one very exciting project, which is a series of letters written to a small boy by his father every day for 2 years, from 1945 to 1947. And the extraordinary thing about them is not so much the text, but the illustrations, because the father was a commercial artist, and they are the most wonderful images of daily life in the 1940s. And you know, we're thrilled to be publishing it.
Yeah, real labour of love.
Absolutely.
Anna Kirk's with us too. Hi, Anna.
Hello, hi.
How's it going?
Yes, the summer publications have gone out, so we're just hearing what people feel about the latest issue, and it looks like it's going to be quite a busy summer ahead.
Do you have any plans for when you all might be back in the office?
Well, we're creeping towards it. Of course, I haven't seen Gail or Hazel or Steph for quite a long time, but Hattie and Jess, yes, we're seeing a little bit more of each other. You know, it's all well and good to be able to talk online, but actually there's nothing quite like just sitting around the office table hashing things out over a big pot of coffee.
But a face-to-face, I couldn't agree more. So my name is Philippa Lamb, and joining us today we have Kate Young. Now, Kate is an award-winning writer, perhaps best known for her Little Library Cookbook and The Little Library Year. Now, that's a literary and culinary almanac. But Kate isn't actually here to talk about food writing specifically today. She's here to talk about a book published in 1967 called Picnic at Hanging Rock. Hello, Kate.
Hello.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Now, look, the book was written by Joan Lindsay.
Yes.
You've written a piece for the Quarterly Magazine about it. Why does it resonate so strongly with you?
You may be able to tell from my accent, some days it's stronger than others. I grew up in Australia and so read Picnic at Hanging Rock at quite a young age, and then adopted it as one of the books that I adored during secondary school, because it was about a girls' school and it was about Australia, and both of those things were things that I knew quite well.
If people haven't read it and they haven't seen the film, can you just give us a quick précis of the plot?
Yes. So Joan Lindsay wrote a book that she essentially introduces by saying, this might be fact or it might be fiction. And I think that that sense of storytelling and mystery and uncertainty pervades the entire plot. But essentially what happens is a group of schoolgirls in 1900, so the year before Australia was federated into a nation rather than a collection of colonies and Indigenous Australian communities, a group of girls who are in a girls' school in rural Victoria go on a day trip to a real rock, Hanging Rock, and a small group of them walk up onto the rock and vanish. And in my head, before I reread it, that is most of the book. The picnic, the Hanging Rock, that day, the vanishing. And actually, I think that's the first maybe 20 pages. And then what follows is the sort of emotional and psychological response of everybody afterwards. What happens back at the school and what happens in the wider community and the search for these girls and the impact that it has on the rest of the people involved in the years to come, actually. And it is really atmospheric, really extraordinary, and a sort of exploration of a story about colonialism, about a group of British people coming to Australia and attempting to create a very British school and a very British idea of what education should be and school should be and school should look like in a country that they really don't understand and in a landscape that they don't understand, and this sort of essentially invasion of the English into Australia.
Yes, because that's what struck me about it is, I mean, these girls, they're in white buttoned up frocks, they're in button boots, they're quintessentially Victorian schoolgirls.
Yes.
And as you say, this is Australia, rural, hot. They're complete oddities in the landscape, aren't they? And that is really central to the book, isn't it?
They really are. And it's Valentine's Day, which in Australia is the height of summer. They are completely out of touch with the landscape. And yeah, it is very much about that idea of just not fitting in to this world and of trying to bend the world to fit them rather than fitting into it. And there are other characters who've come from England as well, including Mike, who's one of the men who goes out to search for these girls. And he much more has sort of understood that the way that he was in England isn't the way that he can be in Australia.
So how does the book play out?
Are we spoilering?
Well, I think we probably are, aren't we? I think so, yes, spoiler alert. But I think we do need to talk about it. Yeah.
I think so. But I think that the atmosphere doesn't disappear on rereading.
Yeah,
so I would say
that
even if we're going to spoiler it here, I still think it's worth having a read or a watch. The Peter Weir film is famously fantastic for a reason. Yeah. It really captures it really beautifully. And Joan Lindsay was on set for a lot of the filming.
Was she? I didn't know that.
Yeah, she had a relationship with the filming. But yes, so essentially one of the girls comes back and is found by Mike and by Alfred, who's Mike's uncle's coachman. They go down on horseback and find one of the girls. The other ones are never found. The girl who is found, Irma, has no real memory of what's happened, can't tell them where she's been for these weeks that she's been vanished. And then essentially the mental state of the headmistress starts to fall apart as well, and her control over this school and her ability to sort of manage that situation, because parents are starting to pull their kids out of school, parents are starting to sort of take this incredibly controlled setup that she's always had away. She ends up climbing up the hill as well after potentially killing one of the girls. Back at the school, she ends up walking up the rock and jumping off it and dying as well. So it is, I mean, it's bleak in its sort of telling of trauma and a response to a lack of control and a lack of being able to fix a narrative and to manage the world around you. I think in that way is incredibly metaphoric. And
yes, because it all disintegrates, doesn't it?
It
all
really
the stuff
does.
They try
it
to
all
impose
falls apart.
Disintegrates, and yet the landscape is totally unchanged.
It does. And you hear years afterwards what happens to lots of characters, and, you know, various teachers go off and one's killed in a fire. There's just so many uncontrollable, horrific things that happen to all of these characters. And yet the rock remains the same. And this question of what happened on the rock and what happened to these girls on the rock is never answered.
Joan Lindsay wrote this book really rapidly, didn't she?
Enormously quickly. She talks about it being this feverish writing experience where she sort of sat in a room and just wrote. And as somebody who writes, that is not, and it has literally never been my experience of writing. I am somebody who sits down to write every day, but in a very structured way.
Yeah, I mean, she got into some sort of flow state, didn't she, with this idea?
Yeah, she had a dream and woke up and then
it persisted until it was done.
Exactly that, yeah.
And of course, people are very obsessed, aren't they, about whether this is a fictionalised version of a true event or plain fiction. I mean, do you have a view?
I mean, it's fiction, but I definitely, when I read it as a teenager, the joy was convincing myself that it was true, because the thrill, of course, is going, well, it's true. Of course it's true. Of course this sort of mystical, awful thing is true. But I think the reality of the situation is that the people who died on that rock and around that rock were Indigenous Australian communities who were massacred around that rock. I read a piece recently by a writer called Madeline Watts, who also grew up in Australia. She's a writer and novelist as well, about Australia's sort of obsession with lost children narratives. The landscape in Australia is so unknowable and uncontrollable and all of these things, and we write these quite extraordinary stories about mostly young white girls being lost in this landscape and taken out, and it's something that you grow up with a fear of disappearing into the landscape. But what we don't talk about is we're a country that was colonised. It started out as a country filled with communities of Indigenous Australians who had a relationship with that land that is incredibly sacred and incredibly understanding and symbiotic. And as British settlers came in and took over the land and tried to make it their own. And I think there is something incredibly moving and powerful about Picnic at Hanging Rock, but I think the story it really doesn't address is all of the people who actually died at the rock.
I mean, this was 1966 when Joan Lindsay was writing, but as I understand it, those sort of questions emerged later than that. So whatever Joan Lindsay had in her mind when she wrote it, the book has a kind of secondary life, doesn't it, in this way? Because it's being used as a jumping off point for conversations that perhaps, well, yes. We don't know whether she ever had herself.
It is really interesting. And I think it is interesting that she set it in 1900 before Australia had come together and federated as a nation.
So, Gail, Anna, have you read it? Do you know this book?
I've not read it. I saw the film. In fact, I was doing a bit of research before the recording. And interestingly, when they filmed it, the cinematographer filmed a lot of it through layers of muslin over the camera. Yeah. In fact, bridal veils he used to give this sort of slightly dreamlike, slightly ethereal feel to it. But the film conveys that sense of mystery and an air of menace in
it. It's so sinister, isn't it? The pace is slow, isn't it? Because it's so hot.
Yeah, it's really that building of atmosphere. You know, it doesn't really matter what the result of the kind of mystery is. It's more that there is this feeling of mystery. And I saw the film before I read the book. It's just so intoxicating. It's almost like these girls are almost drugged. It's this heat. And it makes you think of all of those stories of kind of mass hysteria. And is it true? What's going on here? It's all this sense of uncanny. Yeah. I think that's just really appealing.
It's part of a genre that's called Australian Gothic, and I think that is really key, that sort of link to Gothic literature in the Victorian era, that unknowable darkness and horror that isn't necessarily really explicit on the page.
So interesting that, Kate, because when you think about the European Gothic tradition, you know, it was all castles in mountainous regions of the Tyrol and a damp, wet, cold landscapes.
Yes.
All that translates into Australia, an entirely different landscape. Completely. That is equally terrifying.
Yes. And sort of a complete opposite weather system.
Yes.
But this heat that would be in the 30s at least, and just how pervasive that is, that sort of discomfort of the world around you.
Yeah. I mean, I came across that Lindsay quote when she was asked about, you know, whether it was fictionalized or what exactly it was. And she said, if you can draw your own conclusions, that's fine. But I don't think that it matters. I wrote that book as a sort of atmosphere of a place, and it was like dropping a stone into the water. I thought that was such a beautiful explanation of that novel, don't you think?
Definitely.
Why do we think that kind of schools and boarding schools are such fertile ground for fiction? You know, there is so much, isn't there? Literature, well, you know, some of it's literary, some of it isn't, set in schools. And you're a fan, aren't you, Kate?
Yes, I am. I have been reading school novels since I was a kid. I really enjoyed school a lot. I have a temperament that is incredibly suited to school. I've always kind of been quite well behaved, to a fault, I would say. quite bookish in a way that fits with a school curriculum.
Yeah.
And so I found school quite easy in terms of lessons, managed to do quite well at school. And so it always was a place of kind of joy and happiness for me. I also went to a girls' school, and bullying is horrible, and all of those things happened at our school. But I think generally, I really liked school narratives because they felt familiar, you know, rich with possibility, because as soon as you take parents away, and particularly sort of boarding school narratives where the kids go away together. And yes, they have the teachers, but teachers are always like really easy to escape in lots of ways. And you end up with sort of a group of kids who have a really great time together.
So is it that classic rule of drama, kind of trapping diverse characters in location and seeing what happens?
I really genuinely think it's totally that. You know, all the best episodes of sitcoms are where your central characters are all just stuck in one place. They're the cheap ones to film, but they're also the best because you just get to see how those characters interact together and have impact on each other.
And of course, it's coming of age stories, isn't it? The school age.
Absolutely. It is exactly the right time to be telling stories about, because A, you're so hormonal. So everything is both the best and the worst. Everything is extraordinary and huge and seismic, even when it's tiny. There's a bit in The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie where she says, "Give me a girl at an impressionable age, and she is mine for life."
See, I am intrigued by this because, I mean, unlike you, I can't say that I loved school at all, but I really did love these school stories. I read a lot of them. And for this podcast, I did a bit of a dig, actually, to try and find out where they started. And they started really early. You know, the first one that I came across, the first one, the kind of British boarding school story tradition, apparently started in 1749 with a book by a woman called Sarah Fielding, The Governess. I was intrigued that it started as early as that, because I was thinking about things like Tom Brown's School Days, which was kind of mid-1800s, I think, set at rugby school in England.
Yeah.
And then there was obviously, I think, perhaps where we maybe all started reading stuff. I don't know about you. I read the kind of early 20th century books. I think it's like the Chalet School books, Eleanor Brent Dyer.
Yeah, I think that they're kind of where I started too. And The Naughtiest Girl in the School was my like real introduction into the genre, which is Enid Blyton. And I think most people who read Blyton ended up reading Mallory Towers. But there was something very viscerally thrilling for me, a very good girl, about reading The Naughtiest Girl in the School and all of these things that she ended up getting away with or not getting
away
with.
By the standards of today, I was going to say how naughty
she
could she be.
Not naughty at all. The things that she did, I think in one book, she got in real trouble because she got some money from home and she was supposed to put it in the box so that it could all be shared out. But instead, she bought her best friend a cake and she got in real trouble for that. So naughty.
Now, look, for people who don't know these Chalet School books, I mean, I'm kind of laughing that we're even talking about them because they are hilarious in a way, hilarious period pieces. I mean, they were English girls, but again, they were set abroad in the Austrian Tyrol, I think, weren't they? Is that right?
That's where they started, in Pertisau. In fact, we had a wonderful article by Daisy Hay, who's an academic in English literature, and she wrote a piece for us about her obsession with the Chalet School books, and to the point where she, on a European holiday, made her parents drive hundreds of miles to Pertisau to go and look at the hotel, which is the model for the chalet. They were set in Austria until the Anschluss, weren't they? And then the school had to flee. And
social history.
To Guernsey. Yeah, and then to Herefordshire, and then I think off the Welsh coast.
Yep.
And then it ended up in Switzerland. But I mean, there are 58 books.
So many. It's incredible, isn't it?
And the same characters obviously recur.
Do they?
Throughout.
What, the same age?
No, the two people who set it up, and they start off with three pupils, and this first book, The School at the Chalet, came out in 1925. And then her daughters get involved, and so you go down into second and third generation.
I see. I mean, she wrote till 1970, I believe. I mean, 50 years. Yeah. Kind of incredible.
Extraordinary. And I mean, I think one of the reasons people love them is because of the detail. I mean, the school is trilingual, so, you know, French, German and English. And so there's a lot about food in all three languages. There's a lot about interiors. Girls are forever falling off mountains and getting horribly dangerous illnesses. There's even an online Chalet School bulletin, people posting messages.
I wonder what age these people are, because I don't know what you think, Kate, but you'd kind of wonder whether younger readers would find anything in these books.
Well, it was something that when I started writing about food in fiction, I had never read them as a child, but people got in touch with me with great abiding love for it, talking about the detail of food in it. And a few years ago when I started writing about food and fiction, I was doing that all the time, picking up books that people were recommending.
Yeah.
And they are absolutely rich with detail. You're totally right. The food sounds extraordinary and delicious. And in that way, where boarding school food, either you've got the narrative that the boarding school food is awful. So you've got Jane Eyre, where they're eating horrible porridge.
Gruel.
Or you're talking about extraordinary food because you're away from home and it's so exciting and you've got this tuck box and you're having midnight feasts and you're having all sorts of exciting culinary adventures with your friends.
And you're usually starving because you've been, you know, running about the whole time, having these adventures or doing enforced sports.
Lots of lacrosse.
Yeah.
And I suppose in wartime and rationing, which I think went on till 55,
yeah,
all that stuff about food must have been terribly beguiling. I mean, they have coffee and cakes, don't they, the girls at school every day, which struck me in my London comprehensive school as really good.
On Sundays, they can stay in bed till 9 o'clock in the morning and then they have a breakfast of coffee and rolls and honey.
Yeah, I mean, how lovely is that?
I mean, just a joy.
Yeah, so I think for me it was about, actually it was, you're right, Gail, it was about the kind of falling off mountains and the landscape and the food. It is intriguing, Kate, that you enjoyed them.
Basically, what I try and do is put myself into the mindset of having read it as a child. I generally really love exploring all different kinds of literature in developing recipes from novels. And the food in children's books is just so extraordinarily good. And so I've spent so much time in the past few years writing about this food in children's books. And I think you're right about the sort of wartime rationing as well. The food in children's books in the 40s and 50s is so good. It's so plentiful. Yeah. You've got enormous tables with feasts laid out on them. It's things that kids who were reading those books at that time genuinely would not have been able to get their hands on.
It's like C.S. Lewis, isn't it? And the Narnia
exactly.
books.
The Narnia books, as The Little White Horse, is just so extraordinarily rich with culinary detail. There's so many books around that era that feed kids viscerally through stuff on the page. And I think, you know, if you were a child who is reading those books at 8 years old in the mid-50s, you were born during the war, and you're reading about things not only that you aren't experiencing at that point, but that you don't even remember.
Mm. So is that a feature of all the writers? Because there were lots and lots of these boarding school writers. There was Angela Brazel, Enid Blyton, Elsie Oxenham. It was a huge thing, wasn't it? For decades and decades.
Yeah, it definitely was. I think there are some of them that aren't as rich in food detail as others. And I think that the older they're pitched, so that there are novels like Frost in May, Antonia White's book from the mid-30s, isn't as rich in culinary detail, but is very rich in detail of the school life. But you're right that this telling of a boarding school life, early to mid-20th century, it's a genre that's really enormously popular.
Was it socially aspirational, do you think? Do you think that's why people like them? Because posh girls went to boarding schools?
I wonder if part of it is that. Certainly, I think that most of the boarding school narratives in that era were enormously positive. And I think that that's not always true of boarding school books.
Well, certainly not the boys' books. The boys' boarding school books were much more negative, weren't they? A lot of beatings and dreadful stuff going on.
You know, I'm not sure about speculating whether it was meant to be aspirational at that point, but it definitely felt aspirational to me reading it in the 90s. You know, I definitely wanted to go to boarding school.
Did you?
This joy of being able it made me think, and looking back on it as an adult, I'm shocked by my naivety, but I was absolutely convinced that all I needed to make sort of incredibly good friends was for us to be forced to spend lots of time together in a dormitory without really ever considering that that might be the worst way
really
to
terrible.
Make friends. If you're, yeah, I was furious that my parents were 10 minutes down the road from my school.
Gail, did you go to a boarding school? Am I imagining
that? I did
go
to a boarding school, yes. And it's certainly an experience that had its highs and its lows. But enduring friendships were definitely the one thing for which I'm eternally grateful.
And did you read boarding school books?
No, I didn't.
Maybe people who went to boarding school didn't read these things. The rest of us were thinking, this sounds way better than my school, and I'd like to be in the Austrian Tyrol and eating lovely food and, you know, just a lot more glamorous and exciting and lovely than my own school. But
I mean, there were terrible periods of homesickness, and the food, actually, I'm afraid, at my school was simply frightful.
But did you have your tuck box? Did you have a tuck box from home full of delicious things?
No, we used to have a strange thing where you could get extra fruit each week, and your parents had to pay for it, and this bag of fruit would arrive, and it would sort of languish in your locker, and by the end of the week, most of it had gone off.
I mean, thinking about the genre, of course, not all these books were serious, were they? Because there was Ronald Searle, wasn't there? There was St Trinian's.
Yeah, absolutely.
1941.
Which is fun. Mm.
It was a comic strip, wasn't it? I mean, they have stood the test of time, hasn't it? This idea that, you know, school books where the teachers are sadists, the girls are literally delinquents. I mean, it's quite different to the chalet school, you know, ideal of everyone being obedient. And
where the naughtiest thing you might do is to go and buy your friend a birthday cake.
Yes.
Whereas the Trinity is money you're supposed to donate to the school.
It's much more kind of moral
yes.
lessons being learned, you know, in the Mallory Towers and the chalet school. It's like everybody comes good at the end. And actually, even Angela Brazel as well. It's they might be a little bit naughty at first, but just with some
peer pressure,
by mixing with the well-behaved, that they'll actually come right.
Searle, you've got to love Searle, because he really subverted the genre, didn't he? And of course, so did, if we're getting a bit more literary, so did Evelyn Waugh with Decline and Fall, because so much of that focused on boarding school life and wasn't at all flattering about boarding school life.
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of books, and I think when I think of boarding school novels, I do generally tend to think of the ones that tell it in that quite jolly way. But you're right, like Decline and Fall, but there are loads of contemporary boarding school novels as well that explore what it is to all be away in a place together and maybe not be completely thrilled by that, and maybe have quite volatile relationships between the teachers and the students, and have massive abuses of power when you're away from your parents.
You mentioned The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie earlier on. Would you say that was the start of that, a manipulative relationship between teachers and students? Because that was 1961. It's an old book. Yeah, Muriel Spark, for those who haven't read it, a fantastic book.
So good.
But it's very dark, isn't it?
It is, and it really pulls into question that the girls being at this very impressionable age, where you really want to to figure out who you are, try on different versions of yourself. And when you're doing that in a place where you are surrounded by people who have the potential to manipulate that situation, it can either be a really positive, warm, enriching experience, or it can be incredibly dark.
And that, of course, brings in themes that we have not seen in the books we've been talking about earlier, because it brings in sex, it brings in death and betrayal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's a lot of much more contemporary sort of 21st century fiction never done better than in Never Let Me Go.
Ishiguro's
book, where you start the narrative reading about these children in a boarding school where there's a really pervasive atmosphere of dread and something that isn't quite right. But you're still seeing them mostly do all those things that you would expect them to do. They're playing sport, they're having lessons, they're sleeping in dormitories together, they're forming these friendships. But actually, what they are children who are being raised to donate their organs to keep alive a community of people who are a different class. You know, it is...
Oh my goodness, I've not read this. This sounds absolutely...
Have you not? Oh my gosh, it's so extraordinary. It's so
extraordinary. It
doesn't
get much darker than that, basically.
Yeah, so it is Kazuo Ishiguro's book from 2005, and it's about three friends from this boarding school, Kathy H., Ruth and Tommy, who have quite an interesting relationship as things develop. The dynamics between the three of them shift a lot between childhood and adulthood, but essentially they are on a path that will end with them undergoing a number of operations, donating their organs and probably dying in their 20s.
Oh my goodness.
And they are sent to these boarding schools as essentially an experiment.
They're cattle, aren't they, really?
Yeah, they are cattle. But by the end of the book, you know, the enormous tragedy of it is that it has been decided that the experiment has failed and that the childhood that these children have wasn't really important enough to warrant keeping all of these schools open. And you're left with the sense that the generation that goes after these three, that they probably really are cattle. They never have the childhood that Kathy and Ruth and Tommy had before they knew what was held in their future.
Yeah, it raises all sorts of interesting questions. The other one that came into my mind was Donna Tartt, The Secret History.
Yeah, which is, I think, the sort of college campus novel is a really interesting extension of the boarding school novel, because you have the same sense of these people away from all the other influences in their lives who come very much to rely on each other, and the group dynamics being heightened because you spend so much time together in these small rooms. I mean, The Secret History is fantastic and is such a good exploration of that sort of level of friendship and the things that you come to expect of these people who you make your family, essentially your family away from your family.
Anna, have you read that?
Yes, I love it. It's kind of got that echo of Prime of Miss Jean Brody, and that this group of people, they're specially selected by this classics professor, and it's this very elitist, you know, it's a bit like the Brody set. This is the classics set, and it's almost like predestined because they've been picked out, and then it's cultivation and manipulation of how they are together and how they're set aside from other people. And that's where the intensity comes from. And I mean, that's excellent territory to set a mystery or thriller, which this essentially
is.
Kind of a murder mystery.
These are obviously books for adults, but I mean, Kate, you work in a bookshop, don't you?
I do, yeah.
Are the modern equivalents of people like Eleanor Brent Dyer and Angela Brazel and the Blyton books for children set in boarding schools?
So the ones that I absolutely love are the Murder Most Unladylike series, which is Robin Stevens' series. And it is set in a boarding school in the interwar era again. So it's not contemporary boarding school, although the books are written now. And it's such a great series. The girls are so well drawn. It's about a girls' boarding school in England. It's also about murder. So in each book, somebody is murdered. And they are for kids, but they're so rich, they're so detailed, the characters are so fantastic. And it uses that, once you lock people away together and shut them away in a school, it's a perfect environment for somebody to commit a murder, right? Because there's a limited number of suspects. Everybody sort of knows what everybody else is doing at all times. You know the geography of the school really well. Everything's mapped out really clearly. So if somebody is murdered on school grounds, there's a potential that these 13-year-old characters could potentially solve the murder, which they do in the first book. And then they go on to have this detective society and keep solving murders in the books to come.
Oh, it sounds wonderful.
Watching kids in the bookshop, girls and boys in the bookshop, discover these books is so lovely. And it's also a really self-aware series. It refers constantly to those boarding school novels of the era that we've already been talking about. There's a line in it that says, because Hazel's just arrived at the school, and there's a line that says, "That was the exact moment when I realised that England might not be exactly how it had seemed in my jolly school story books."
Yeah.
And then it is kind of subverted while still remaining that kind of boarding school novel that we expect it to be.
Yeah, I was just thinking about, I can't quite remember when Hilary Mantel's An Experiment in Love was published. Maybe I think that was the 90s, mid-90s. That's actually both school and university, and that follows a character who was accepted on a scholarship. She's from a very working class background, and it's like a school in the north. Interesting that actually it's not really one of Mantel's most well-known, but I really enjoyed it, and I think, again, that's got a darker edge to it. I mean, a tragedy happens towards the end of that it's kind of reminiscent of Prime of Misty and Brodie as well, I think.
We had a very clear example of just how enduring, you know, the sort of popularity is of these books when we published a non-fiction book about girls' boarding schools called Terms and Conditions by Isenda Maxton Graham. And in it, she records people's memories of girls' boarding schools between 1939 and 1979. And it's remarkable how these girls, you know, how strong their memories are, whether they're good or they're bad. The whole experience made such an impression on them. And we sold thousands of copies of that. I think that that kind of boarding school no longer exists because of mobile phones and, you know, life has changed so much. They're no longer these sort of hermetically sealed units that they used to be, you know, when your
That's
parents probably only
point,
saw you,
Gail.
You know, maybe at half term, if that.
So obviously we had all these writers, all these boarding school stories through the 20th century. And then it does seem to me it kind of faltered for obviously reasons of fashion, I think, and politics in the late 60s, early 70s. Then we had the Worst Witch books. That was Jill Murphy. Obviously, she's still writing, I think. Started in the 70s. But beyond that, I can't immediately think of many other boarding school stories, of course, until we get to Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling, and the whole genre bursts into bloom again, with a raft of new writers and, of course, the Harry Potter phenomenon.
Yeah, I think that The Worst Witch, which is Jill Murphy's series, is, again, it's about a girl who is a witch who attends witches' school. It's a series of books that first came out in, I think, the mid-70s, 74. They've actually continued to be published through into the 21st century.
Did you read those, Anna? Did I hear you saying yes?
Yes, I did read them. And I think they are still being read today by young people.
Very much. We sell them all the time in the shop.
Yeah, like in television adaptations and things like that. But yeah, I absolutely loved them. I reread them over and over and over again as a child. Mildred and Maud were like my own friends.
Yeah, exactly. And the first book in the series was made into a TV film in the mid-80s. So that had a huge impact on kids who were growing up around that time.
I don't know how I came to miss those, but they obviously did. Yeah. So, Kate, I know, I mean, getting back to the food thing, which we all enjoyed, the element of this, I know you've written a lot about that, haven't you, about boarding school food? And I think you've written about tuck boxes specifically, haven't you? This lovely idea of goodies.
Yeah, exactly that. I wrote about it because I never really had one. I had a lunchbox that I took to school every day. The primary joy of going to a boarding school seemed to me that you would pack a wooden box full of delicious things to share with your friends. And I grew up completely obsessed with it. So in my second book, there is a section that talks about tuck boxes. Blackberry jam from the naughtiest girl in the school and plum buns from chalet school and, you know, all sorts of delicious things that you might end up taking away with you. But the best, I just want to read a little, can I read a little bit
of
Our Lady in the Nile, which was published in 2012 that I wish that I'd read before I wrote this bit in my book, because this quote is so fantastic. So it's set in Rwanda in the 1980s, and this quote goes, "So suitcases became well-stocked pantries filled by doting mothers. Beans and cassava paste with a special sauce, bananas slowly baked overnight, red sweet potatoes, corn cobs, peanuts, and even, for the city girls, donuts of every colour under the sun, a secret Swahili recipe. At night, as soon as the monitor had left the dorm, the feast began. The suitcases were opened and all the victuals laid out on the beds.
That makes me think, I just remembered that memory of Mallory Towers where Daryl Rivers, she gets into a bit of a tussle with a young girl who was threatening to reveal the secret of a midnight feast held by the fourth formers. And this has caused her to have such a rage. It was this girl and then she gets into trouble for it. And this is the high drama of the set piece.
And when was that written, Kate? Remind me again.
2012.
See, isn't that fascinating as well? Because that circles us right back to Picnic at Hanging Rock, doesn't it? Because it's this is Rwanda, and this is girls with tuck boxes, and that imposition of the traditional British model on places, you know, so far, far away.
Yeah, intriguing. Absolutely that.
I think we'll wrap it up there. I kind of feel we could go on about that forever. We probably need to stop, actually. Thanks very much, Kate. Will you stay with us and give us a couple of recommended reads in a moment?
Oh, for sure.
Okay, so before we move on, a brief word about Slightly Foxed. Elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Now that life is joyously becoming freer, we can actually plan trips now. And Anna, you have another Book Lovers Day out for us.
So, yes, I'm going to talk about the House of Illustration. So the House of Illustration is in Granary Square in King's Cross, founded by Quentin Blake. It's in the middle of kind of open space of Granary Square. They just have a series of exhibitions showing all sorts of different illustrations, children's books or, artist illustrations. They run book illustration competitions with Folio Society. So, yeah, I mean, it's great to kind of delve into a specific illustrator. And actually, I've been to somewhere I had recognised from their advertising materials, like, oh, I recognise that illustration from a book that I've read. And then you realise they've had this whole wealth of work and there are so many things that they've illustrated. For instance, past exhibitions have included Posy Simmons.
A great friend of Slightly Foxed, yeah.
Exactly. Then there was the first ever display of Ludwig Bemelmann's sketches for Madeline.
Oh, a great favourite of mine.
Yeah, about the French schoolgirl who goes to a boarding school in Paris. E.H. Shepherd, who we've published a pair of illustrated memoirs here at Drawn from Memory and Drawn from Life, but they had an exhibition of his war illustrations. I mean, he's best known for Winnie the Pooh and The Wind in the Willows, but this was something a little bit different.
I saw that actually, Anna.
Oh, I remember did you?
I did, and it was really striking. Yeah, it was great.
I'm sure. Well, the first one that I went to was a retrospective of Edward Ardizzone's work. We published his memoir as well, The Young Ardizzone. I know him from Noel Langley's The Land of Green Ginger, but he also did the Little Tim and Lucy books. So yeah, they've had all sorts of things, like original illustrations for Lady Bird books, but then also Paula Rego sketches and props, and of course, many different selections and collections of Quentin Blake's work. I mean, that's only going to increase because they're currently developing the Quentin Blake Centre for Illustration in Islington, which will open next year, and that it's going to be the permanent home for the archive of Quentin Blake.
Thanks, Anna. I'm going to ask you all for book recommendations now. Kate, can I start with you?
This recommendation comes just before I finished the book. I really tried to finish it before today, but I've just did not quite make it. It's a 600-ish page novel, and it absolutely flies along because it is the most fun book I've read in so long. It's Plain Bad Heroines, which is by Emily M. Danforth, and it came out only, I think, in April of this year. It is a story within a story within a story. It's essentially a film being made that is adapting a book within a book. And it is about an early 20th century boarding school and a contemporary film. And it is about unexplained deaths in a school, the sort of film industry. And it is just so much fun. It's super camp. It's like every single central character is a woman and is also queer. It's just a thrill to read, and I absolutely love it. I have been having so much fun reading it. And I think in terms of an addition to the genre of boarding school narratives, it's a really extraordinarily intertextual one, what it references and what it's talking about, and also just its understanding of the genre and then its skewering of the genre.
Yeah, a whole new iteration.
It's just so much fun. That's yeah.
Perfect. Gail, what have you got for us?
I've got the classic series of boarding school books, Anthony Buckeridge's books about two prep school boys called J.C.T. Jennings and Charles Edwin Jeremy Derbyshire. And they are new pupils at Limbury Court Preparatory School. First book was published in 1950 called Jennings Goes to School. And there are 24 of them in all, and they follow Jennings and Derbyshire. They've got the same innocence and sense of fun as P.G. Wodehouse. And the joy of them is the comedy. He manages to capture small boys' optimism and their mistakes and their sort of wonky assessment of the consequences of their actions.
Yeah.
And their kind of crosswired logic about things. They are an absolute joy to read. The masters, the headmaster is called Mr. Pemberton Oakes, and he's rather idle and bumbling, and he's far more likely to be doing crosswords than writing school reports. And then there's Mr. Wilkins, who has an explosive temper, and he's contrasted with Mr. Carter, who's avuncular and absolutely does understand small boys and their rather surreal thought processes. They're just tremendous fun, and they're the sort of antithesis of, you know, William Golding's Lord of the Flies, which is another, I know, not set at a boarding school.
Of course, yeah,
school,
we didn't
but,
even talk
you know,
about that, did we? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, that's a sort of dystopian view of young boys, whereas the Anthony Buckeridge books are just, they're full of joy.
Are they still in print, Gail?
I think they are. And there was a wonderful, in the 1990s, Stephen Fry did an audio version of them, which, I mean, you know, they have you in stitches.
Anna?
Well, I actually returned to a book that I read maybe 15 years ago or so. It's the first of a trilogy, and the third one was actually just published last year, so I'm trying to do a bit of rereadings. So it's called Nervous Conditions by Tsitsi Dangarembga, and it is set in Zimbabwe 20 years before independence. So it's a family in post-colonial Rhodesia during the 1960s. It's the story of 13-year-old Tambu and essentially her quest for education. Her older brother, Namo, he was the one who was sent to missionary school in her family. He's the only boy.
Right.
And it opens with news of Namo's death, her brother's death. He'd become distanced from the family. He was away at school. He'd gone on to a different life. So Tambu, who is desperate to go to school, but the family can't afford it, she's given this opportunity to actually take her brother's place, which just kind of changes her world. She wholly commits to her studying. She's completely consumed by it. She doesn't want to return home in the holidays. And she is then given the chance to win a scholarship to a better school and gets in there and is just introduced to a completely different way of living. It's completely, you know, a cultural shock, and she's quite resistant to those changes. And it's this kind of tension between she wants to strive for better, but she also feels very uncomfortable and nervous of where this actually takes her, where she's found herself, balancing all of the pressures from her family wanting to succeed, all of this on her shoulders, but, you know, she wants her own independence. But I was really struck by reading it now. I think I read it with perhaps much more of a cultural and political hat on, but essentially it's a coming of age story of just her life, but also the story of cultural imperialism. So it's not a gentle read necessarily, but I was very happy to go back to it, and I am now going to read the next two in the trilogy, which of course have been written over quite some time, so it'll be an interesting read, I think.
Long time. Well, I think we've covered the true immense diversity of boarding school books with those recommendations. It's a fantastic group of books. Thank you very much. That's about all we've got time for, I think, this month. But Kate, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We have really enjoyed it. It's been a fascinating discussion. We will be back next month. Take a look at the show notes if you'd like to be reminded of any of the writers and the books. And I know there's been a lot this month. Please do take a moment to rate, review and share the podcast if you're enjoying them. But until July, thanks for listening and for joining us on another literary trek off the beaten track.